Hello and welcome to another Deeper Wave Dialogue. My name is Richard Cox and I'm here again with Tim Freak. And this is one of the ones we're going to look at some of the content and questions that have come up on Tim's Facebook forum recently. And one of the pictures posted was a picture of Gene Wilder in his Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory role. And there was a quote on the picture saying, "So, you're a Gnostic. Tell me how blaming evil on the demiurge excuses the true God." Now, I don't know why Gene Wilder. I don't know if this is a clever reference to Charlie and the Chocolate Factory containing Gnostic mythic themes. I'm never bright enough to pick up on these things. But it does give us a good excuse to talk about Tim's work on Gnosticism, on who and what the demiurge is, and on how Tim's work around ethics and his views on ethics, the problem of evil, has evolved, changed, or stayed the same over time, and now with the release of Soul Story. So, Tim, good morning.
Good morning.
So, I think we better start off with this figure, the Demiurge. It's a character you wrote quite a bit about in Jesus and the Goddess, principally, as well as other books. A character I think you first find in Plato as a sort of benign character, and then a more evil character of the Gnostics. So can you give us a mythic historic overview of who he is? And if you can explain his role in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, then you can do that also.
Alas, I can't. Although the chance of getting to comment on Willy Wonka is a delight that I never thought I'd ever have. And I think, you know, the post is lovely. I mean, I find it really funny because it captures, as we'll explore, something beautiful about Gnosticism, the contradiction in Gnosticism, really, and attributing it to Willy Wonka is somehow very amusing. So the Demiurge, it weird name. You find it in the Greeks, you find it in Plato, and it's the idea of the craftsman the god who crafts the universe, the creator. And with the Gnostics, you get the same thing, but here it's very clearly a negative figure. And there's various reasons why they make that transformation. So what the Gnostics are wrestling with is, like all of us, their past. We all have our individual and cultural past, which we have to make sense of. And for them, they had their whole Jewish heritage and their, as we've explored, their pagan heritage. They had both going on. How can they bring together this deep philosophical understanding that was coming from Neoplatonism and the work that had come from the Greeks with their own tradition? And in their own tradition, they have this figure of a creator god, Yahweh. And he's a jealous god. He's not a particularly nice figure. And so the way they dealt with that was they went, well, there's a benign god, which is the real god, which is behind everything. And then there's this kind of false god or this lesser figure who is flawed and who creates this imperfect world. And in what they did in one act there was they took Yahweh and explained why he wasn't a very nice figure and why what was wrong with the Jewish heritage they got, because they pointed to his flaws and that was this deeper god behind. And they also dealt with the problem of evil, which I'm sure we can go into in more detail, mm-hmm. which is essentially, you know, why the hell, if this is created by a good God, is there so much terrible suffering in the world?
So the Demiurge, the lesser God, comes from the one true God, doesn't he? In an act of ignorance, is it?
Yes. I mean, what you get with, and we discussed this, I think, in our previous dialogue, that spirituality, ancient spirituality, and still most today, has a very negative view of the world in that we are fallen. We've fallen into a state of delusion or ignorance, and we need to return to a state of enlightenment or spirituality. And so whereas what I've been interested in and what I think is the modern way, which is an evolutionary way, which sees everything as evolving towards the good, becoming greater, their view is the opposite, that things have fallen from the good into the lesser. So it's come from the pleroma, the fullness, into the kenoma, the deficiency. And part of that, so they don't just see it as a very, you have a very complicated system of the way in which reality has unfolded philosophically in getting in its journey down into materiality. And then right at the end of that, you get this incredible myth, which is too big to go into in detail, but usually featured around Achamoth or Sophia, a goddess figure who has many names, who is a kind of a mother figure. You've ended up with this female deity who then gives birth to an abortion, obviously, often it's called, which is she has this child who is going to be the demiurge. And the demiurge is a kind of expression of her own ignorance, her fallen state. And he creates a fallen world in which we are lost.
Okay, so that's on a cosmic level. I believe you also wrote in Jesus and the Goddess how on a personal level, the demiurge is equatable with the ego. So we have this deep, true consciousness behind the one God, and then the lesser God, the ego, which creates our lives in some way.
Yes. I mean, what I was trying to do with the book Jesus and the Goddess was to try and go, well, how can we understand what this mythology is pointing to? How can we understand its mythic allegorical content? Because I think a lot of it was consciously created as allegory, and even the stuff that wasn't consciously created, it can't help but contain it because it's come from the psyche, the soul. And my sense was, here's an analogy for what we're all experiencing, is that there's this deeper presence of this deep oneness, this goodness, and then there's this other part of me, which is Tim, which is in this ambiguous state in the world. Now, for a lot of the ancient spirituality, the ego is seen in a very, very negative light, not all. And what I did was try and pull out the places where we don't have to see it in a negative light, because I believe that the Gnosticism we need to take us forward has a positive view of the nature of the ego. And I was quite pleased with myself. Before this conversation, I've got it out with me now. I got the book together and looked through it. I haven't read it for ages, you know, as you don't. And I thought, this is pretty good, actually. there's a good mythic, for those who like mythology and philosophy, there's some really good mythic content in here. And I had actually done a precursor to the Willy Wonka quote, where I actually said in the book, look, it's kind of crazy, because if God is, you know, the great one good God is creating everything, everything's coming from them in this process of the fall, then how does that excuse them for the evil of the world? Because there's this fallen being in between, because ultimately the responsibility must go all the way back. And so I highlighted that very issue. And what the Gnostics, I think, were onto that as well, some of them, what they had was the idea that it was kind of a fall, and it was, but also it was something benign going on too, and that the real God put sparks of spirit in all of the human beings, which the demiurge creates, because through that they were going to become conscious and realize themselves. So it was kind of a play, an outpouring, and the role of the ego and the separate self could seem negative, seem like it trapped you in separateness, but actually even that had a benign purpose, which was to individuate and make you more conscious and allow the soul to
come. Is the demiurge equatable with another concept you wrote about in the book, the archons, the idea of like rulers of this world who are in spirit and might act in a negative way to trap consciousness in the body? Are they equatable characters or something?
Well, first of all, the thing to get, you know, I've got to be clear about this, is that there are myriad Gnostic systems. Hmm. With lots of different approaches, and the archons are particularly complicated. So you have this, the aeons, which are like the principal things in this devolution from spirit into matter. And then that gives rise to the demiurge and to these figures as archons, which are like negative influences, which are, you know, become the devil and all of that, which are holding us into captivity. And you do get a strand of Gnosticism, a significant strand, which is, I guess you might say, just paranoid. I mean, it's very, and you can see it still going on today. There's a positive gnosis which discovers that awakening to oneness and love. And then there's a kind of negative gnosis which concentrates on what's pushing me down here. Oh, it's them. It's something outside of me that's It's making
that's quite fascinating to me how Gnosis and Gnostic philosophy continues in all its forms, maybe not called that, throughout the ages right up to the present day, in both literature and in ways to directly interpret reality in a literal way. So in literature, you have films like The Matrix, which very Gnostic, and the idea of Archons' powers, the agents keeping people down.
Yeah.
And then in a more literal way, you have someone like David Icke, who's writing stuff that people have differing views on now. But I wonder if in like 1,000 years' time, people might look back and say, oh, this was a reemergence of Gnostic mythology taken literally in the late 20th, early 21st century.
Great comment, and great to bring that up, Richard. Yes. So
just so people don't know, David Icke writes conspiracy theory, but they go sort of to an otherworldly place where there are these archontic, dark, spiritual beings acting through the powers in the world to suppress everyone. And the role of human life is to find a kind of enlightenment and a freedom from this spiritually.
Yeah, and then manifesting as lizard people who transmute into 30 lizards, including many, many people you would know, celebrities and royalty.
Yes, so it has a kind of, an aspect which is kind of hard to believe to it, but...
Yeah. So what you've got, I think, there is with the Matrix, a kind of Gnostic fantasy of real genius, actually, and then with David, a Gnostic fantasy of real paranoia. And, but you're right. They're both playing out this same idea. And as much as I love the Matrix, and I thought it was the first one, especially a really great movie, you do see the negative Gnosis. Mm. And then, because what happens to the figure of Neo who wakes up? What he wakes up to is the reality, which is worse than he could possibly have imagined. And what he was asleep into was, it's okay. And that is a very negative form of the negative Gnosis. So, because my experience is that when you wake up, you realize it's much better than you thought, not much worse than you thought. Mm. And that's quite a big difference. Whereas the negative Gnosis is like, you really see that there's these malevolent things controlling everything and having a keeping us down, keeping us in prison, keeping us prisoners. So, I would see it all very differently now.
Right. To come back to the ethics then, another thing I remember you writing in Jesus and the Goddess was in attempting to explain the problem of evil, the Gnostics give an analogy of like, well, to a child, the parents can appear to be alternating between good and bad, because sometimes you're allowed to do things and given sweets and whatever else, and sometimes they discipline you and you're sent to your room. But from the parents' perspective, they're always acting in the good. As an analogy. To God then, who from our human experience, good things and bad things happen, but from God's perspective, so to speak, everything is working towards spiritual awakening. And this is a way of explaining why bad things happen, why evil things happen, because it's all awakening consciousness. Is that an accurate summation of what you wrote? And is that equatable to, or different?
Okay, so first of all, that was my analogy. I don't want to put that in the words of the mouth. Right. They didn't actually say that, but it was my analogy to try and draw out what I think was what was this strand of the positive Gnosis, really, which was going, okay, behind it all this is being of love, the real God that Jesus reveals and replaces the false God, who's the eye for an eye God of law. And as St. Paul says, that, you know, the figure of Jesus comes to replace the law, which is rigid and punitive, with love. And that's the great revelation of the Gnosis. And so you kind of, and so what they're expressing, what I'm expressing there in my interpretation, is a major strand which goes through most spiritual thought, which I feel now I want to question or see in a different way, because it doesn't really work, I don't think. But it articulates an intuition I think a lot of people have, where you wake up, and you can get it with the paralogical thinking, it can help, where you look at it one way and it's like the world really is a difficult place with awful things happening, and then you come to another place and you go, and even with that, it's all perfect. And there's something benign happening. And I think these are all attempts to kind of explain how that can be true. Now, what's happened for me is I've gone, the ways of explaining it, I mean, the paralogical way still works for me, going, look, it's a paradox. They both exist together. And I do feel that's important. I never ever go, it's just all perfect, without first going, I know it's also not. Because that just feels like I have to honor that for myself and for people who are suffering. But what I've done with my new philosophy of really focusing on the evolutionary process of emergence, I think has enabled me to understand that much deeper and explain that in a much more elegant way, which is to go, the big mistake for all, I think all forms, apart from a few modern figures, is you want to put this being of love, this true God, at the beginning of time. And if you put that figure at the beginning of time, that figure is responsible for the malevolent nature of the universe. And you have to come up with some fudge to go, okay, well, you know, it's all for the best. And then you kind of, but then it's very hard when you go, yes, that little children get AIDS and that, you know, whole species can be wiped out and all for the, you know, the hurricane has just flattened an island and ruined everyone's lives. And that's for the best, if we knew the greater wisdom. And to be honest with you, that just feels like nonsense to me. I can't go there. But so the big transition for me in that respect with emergent spirituality was going, look, this experience of oneness and the being of love, God, is not at the beginning, it's at the end, or it's where the universe is going. We're evolving towards that. So it's not there allowing the evolutionary process, the 120 million years of dinosaurs, five major extinctions. It's like, it's not the crazy. It's actually that the whole universe is birthing God. It is God being born and coming into existence. And what I relate to when I feel deep awake, what I have right now, it's like there is a being of love holding us. But that being of love wasn't at the beginning. It's not a crazy being responsible for evil. It's actually what this process of dialectics, of duality, is actually resolving into. And that's a newer way of approaching the Gnostic problem. And that's why what I'm doing is kind of neo-Gnosticism, a post-evolutionary Gnosticism.
Okay. So one of the things that was reflected on the forum was people saying, I was quite happy with the ethical system as it was presented in Gnosticism and Jesus and the Goddess. Just to summarize that and to try and get where the problem you've come to see it is, I think I'm actually thinking of your book In the Light of Death, because that was a book that brought up, bad things happen in life. You grow old, you get sick, you die. Okay. And how can that be okay in the presence of a God of love? Why is this bad stuff happening? And death brings you profoundly close to that question. And in the last discussion we had, we talked about reality. Is it a dream? Is it similar to a dream? So to look at the perennial philosophy on this, as I would understand it, we could say, okay, if I'm dreaming at night, all sorts of terrible things can happen, all sorts of random things can happen, and that can seem to be awful from the perspective of my character in the dream. But on another level, it's okay, because I'm not the character in the dream. I'm the conscious awareness witnessing the dream. And I believe that's the view you put forward about 10, 15 years ago in Jesus and the Goddess and in the Light of Death. And that's what you're now, you've gone on a journey where you don't find that quite as satisfactory.
Look, for us to understand it, that still works. It's like, and it is true. I mean, it is that, you know, if you understand that you are soul, which isn't made of matter, and that you will survive the life and death of the body and experience the soul realm, which you're touching already, and that you'll go on to experience that after the death of the body, and you're something which can't be extinguished, then even the terrible things that are happening to the little children I mentioned before are redeemable, because it will work its way out. And it is like a bad dream, awful as that is. So that is still, there's still some deep truth in that, which is good to hang on to and know. The problem with it philosophically, and what I'm looking for is a whole new worldview, which can encompass our whole human experience, is it's incredibly anthropocentric. It works if you're a human being, but it doesn't work if you want to talk about the universe before there were human beings. It doesn't talk about the universe for 10 billion years before there was any life. It doesn't talk about the whole, you know, the human beings, a tiny, tiny, tiny bit at the end. So then you've got, well, what's all that about? And so then using those analogies, which work great for us, and an awful lot of spirituality is like that. It works brilliantly if you just contain it to your human experience. Mm-hmm. If you want to enlarge it out to the experience of the whole cosmos, then philosophically it begins to fray at the edges. So that's why I've gone, look, let's take that intuition and couch it in a different way. And we can keep that, but we can add to it something which allows us to understand this unfolding. So for you and I, you could say simply like, well, if you're going to have pleasure, there's going to be pain, and dualities exist together. And that's helpful because it's true. And you can see that that's true. But if you want to go back and see how that's evolved, then I think what you see is how that's come into being. So can I just roll on this for a second?
Yeah, please.
It feels like what I'm saying now is, look, if you take the evolutionary scope, you can still see the potentiality, which is non-dual, coming into duality, a duality of subject and object. And part of that was the duality of good and bad, although obviously before there's consciousness, no one's making that judgment. And the big duality you're getting is in time, that you've got past and possible. You've got the accumulation of time. And with the accumulation of time, the emergence of ever deeper levels of realization through matter to life to soul. And what happens with that, I think, is you're constantly living with the past. And the past is a foundation from which the new will emerge, but it's also a limit. You know, we could, the things that you and I could say or do in this moment are infinite. I mean, there's the potential, but they will have to start from now. We can't be anywhere else or be anyone else. We must, so that we're limited now. You get that whole thing in Pythagoreanism, the limitless, which for me is the potentiality, and then the limited, which is form in time. And that limitedness manifests as what can become evil or bad in its negative sense. It's good in its foundational sense and negative, so that I have to live with the causality of life. We have to live with the biology of life. And the hurricanes just happened, a natural evil, as it would be called. Not because some benign God allowed it, but just because the way the natural world evolved, the physicality of it, means that those phenomena happen and we have to live with it. We've evolved as human beings. Therefore, we've got all the advantages of that evolution, but we've got suffering. Why? Because it's good for species if they suffer, because it keeps them alive. But if bad, really bad for individuals, and now we've become individuated, we want to get rid of it, which is why we're working really hard in medicine and so forth to limit it, why we don't just allow so many mothers and children to die in childbirth. But nature was fine with that. Let the weak ones die, because they was interested in survival of the species. So all of that's an evil to us because it's the past. And then in society, you see the same thing. Things which seemed like they were cutting edge at one period in history and were, you know, really great, we look back on them and think they're horrendous, and rightfully so. So when we see, the example I use in Soul Story, which I think is quite a good one, is to take someone like Adolf Hitler. You take Adolf Hitler and you imagine him existing 2,000 years ago, he would have probably been Adolf the Great, like Charlemagne the Great or Alexander the Great, a conqueror and a heroic figure. But because it was in the 20th century, you know, he went out and, you know, when Richard I went out and slaughtered thousands and thousands of thousands of people, just butchered them one after the other all day, we look back and go, my God. And yet still he's like a figure in history. When Hitler does it now, he does it, he's evil, and rightfully so. So what I feel like we're dealing with is the negative aspect of the past, which we're always trying to transcend. Why? Because we're being pulled forward by the potentiality of good, which allows us to, you know, we have to bring that greater goodness into the world. That's our role.
Do you see this view as slotting inside one of the Gnostic frameworks? So at one end of the spectrum, say, you could take the view that all reality is directly reflecting consciousness all the time, whether it's a hurricane or something very good happening, winning a prize or something, or dying in childbirth, or everything is a direct reflection of consciousness. Or at another point on the spectrum, you could say, okay, some of reality is reflecting consciousness and the mind is manifesting in the world, but the world also plays by its own rules. Of would that be narrativity in the way you're describing
it? That's beyond. I'm saying the latter. I'd say, look, the whole cosmos is a reflection of realization. You know, so it's not, you know, it's not, it's a reflection of what's been realized, and it's what we are. We are the cosmos, all of us. That's, there is nothing else that we can be, and that therefore all of it is what we are. But it's, but the reflectivity that happens between our experience of soul, or that storyness, I think is not, is not that that controls everything, which is very popular idea, say in the store, in the secret and those ideas. That, you know, somehow, you know, you're only here because you're playing a role in my existence. It doesn't, it, philosophically, it's very naive and doesn't hold up to any sort of scrutiny. But what does hold up to scrutiny, I believe, is to say that all these levels of evolutionary emergence are functioning together. So there is a brute level of materiality which will cause the storm. It just will. And then there's a biological level where that's going to have a biological effect and survival and blah, blah. And that's, we have to live with that. And then there's the level of soul where we can respond to that. We have humanity. We can disregard it, or we can respond with compassion, or so that we're in, so all of those levels are happening together. And then there's another level in the soul, what I call the narrativity, which is affecting, which is going downwards. So it's not just the effects going upwards. The effect of narrativity, of the storiness of soul, is affecting how things happen. So there may be people for whom they're going, oh my God, that hurricane has just played this huge role in my soul journey. Many people, but we don't, but not everyone. For some people, it will just be a disaster, and not because they're stupid or missing it, but because that's what it is for them. And we should reach out with compassion and humanity. And then there's other people for whom it seems to form some part of their story. And that's what I mean by the narrativity. So somehow it feels like with that model, I'm not claiming to be able to do this, but with that model, there's the potential for weaving together all of the different levels of our experience, allowing evil to be evil, to be something bad, but also to see where it's coming from and how we deal with it. So is that Gnosticism, you asked? I don't really know. Is this a neo-Gnostic philosophy? I guess, but it's quite a new one because it's evolutionary. That's the big change. It's not falling from God into the kenoma. It's actually going, look, possibility, the pleroma, the possibility of things is where it's all come from, but in the process of realizing, it's realizing deeper and deeper things, and it's reaching towards a being of love, which is coming into being, and therefore we are that coming into itself. So it's a very positive form of the Gnosis, and that's because my experience of awakening throughout the whole of my life has always been, when I awaken deeply, I become more positive and more, and there's a deep goodness to it, which fills me with faith, actually, in, but not faith in a creed, but faith in the goodness, the benign nature of existence. Not because there isn't the unbenign nature, but because it's going towards the good.
Okay, Tim, my brain has a narrativity that kicks in, and I can only contemplate these deep questions for so long, and it runs out, and I think we've covered quite a lot there. Deep questions. So this video will be on Tim's Facebook forum page, and please, people, jump in with any questions or comments, and we can always record something in the future going into any points that arise more deeply. And if anyone wants to write something on Charlie and the Chocolate Factory as a Gnostic myth and explain that to us, we'd be very grateful to receive it.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks very much, Tim. See you soon.
Thank you, Richard.